From the studios of KPCW, welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. I'm Claire Wiley. And on the show today, Chris and I are going to be speaking with Ryan Langendorf. Langendorf is a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder and worked with the Doak Lab. He's also one of the authors of a new study about sea otters who are working as a keystone species to help regenerate kelp forests. He talks us through what this means for those ecosystems and why it matters to all of us. And then all the way from Guam, we're visited by marine biologist Rania Steinbach, who talks about marine fungi. Steinbach is part of a team studying the role of marine fungi that they are playing in degrading plastics. Her research highlights a largely untapped resource that is helping to remove plastics from the ocean. All that is coming up on This Green Earth, right after a word from our sponsors. But before we get to that, I do want to mention that if you are out on those roads, it is slow going in several areas. There is an incident on westbound I-80 around the Summit Park area. So if you're coming up that way, just know that there is going to be a lot of delays happening, and there is also restrictions happening at Marsac. So if you wanted to go up into Deer Valley, there are some road restrictions there for vehicles. So just be careful out there, and thank you for tuning in to This Green Earth.
Good morning and welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us now is Ryan Elman Langendorf. Ryan is a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder and works with the Doak Lab. So Ryan, let's have you share a little background on yourself, what you do at the university and your studies and what's happening with the Doak Lab.
Yeah, well, first, it's just great to be with both of you. Thanks for having me on. I'm an ecologist by training. And the Doak Lab, they're quantitative ecologists at the University of Colorado, which is where I did my PhD. That's how I met Dan. And then somewhere during my PhD, I sort of morphed from a field biologist into more of a computational mathematical modeler kind of ecologist. And that was a huge part of what led me into this research on kelp forests, trying to just understand how these ecosystems function.
So one of the studies you've recently penned has to do with sea otters and the role they play in helping to stabilize kelp forests, which are imperative for not only animals that directly inhabit those areas, but also for all of us. So in this study, you identify sea otters as keystone species. So first, why don't we define what a keystone species is, and then give us some solid characteristics and basically attributes of the sea otter. Let's break down these creatures.
Yeah, well, the idea of a keystone species, it's a metaphor for an arch, and that last stone that you drop in at the very top of the arch as you're building it, the rest of the stones kind of push up against it, and that one at the center at the top, it sort of holds all the weight and keeps the whole thing from falling apart. And ecologists love this metaphor because some species are just disproportionately important to their ecosystem, and if they weren't there, the whole arch, the system would fall apart. So that's where the idea of a keystone species comes from. And yeah, sea otters are one of these. They love eating urchins, among other things. They're a predator. And they're pretty adorable in how they do this. They catch urchins, and they love to come up to the surface and float on their back and eat their meal. And they'll hold hands with each other and form these large floating rafts. But while they're snacking on urchins, they're performing this really important service for the ecosystem, which is to keep the urchins from overgrazing all the kelp and just sort of slowly destroying the entire underwater forest. And so by doing this, they allow the entire system to kind of reach a different kind of balance where lots of different species can coexist. It's not to say that there's no change going on, but they prevent the system from falling apart and turning into what's called an urchin baron, which is all these little zombie urchins that are wandering around looking for more kelp, but they've just eaten up all the kelp and all the fish and other species leave, and the system really falls apart. And so they're, because their presence keeps the kelp forest alive, they're considered a keystone species.
Yeah, that's super interesting because the sea urchins, while they have their purpose, they are rapidly moving through these kelp forests and degrading them. And so can you describe for us that ecosystem and kind of what's living there peacefully, and then what the sea urchin's role is? Does it have a role in that ecosystem that's positive? And then also why they need to be kept in check and why there needs to be a sea otter around to do so?
You know, that's a great question. They're always painted as the villain of the story. I mean, I think that without sea urchins at all, they also help to sort of like allow some amount of disturbance to the kelp, allows more kelp species to live there. There's all kinds of other things. There's snails, there's abalone, there are sea stars. There's some really big sea stars that are also predators in this system, these giant sunflower stars. There are cucumbers. There's all kinds of things living here. But what happens is, the urchins, they just have an insatiable appetite. And there's a couple different urchin species. The big ones are red and purple urchins. And if they're left unchecked, they'll just eat up everything to the point where all these other species just don't have the infrastructure of the forest. They really do look like underwater forests. And if all the plants are eaten up, then there's no shelter, there's no place to hide from predators, there's nothing else for other species to eat, and the system kind of falls apart.
Yeah, the sea urchins are also in the cycle here because they are a food source to these stars
That's
and
right.
these
That's absolutely
otters.
right. Yeah, if they weren't there being a food source for sea otters, then it would be harder for sea otters to exist there. And they do all sort of need each other to keep this system alive. But some species, if left unchecked, would just sort of slowly destroy it, not intentionally, in the same way that I don't think it's like the sea otters they're not trying to build a kelp forest, but through their actions, they're able to suppress the urchins enough so that the urchins, who are not trying to destroy their home either, they don't want the kelp forest to disappear, but they just lose sight of what they're doing and they eat up all the kelp.
So, Ryan, prior to man showing up, these kelp forests were ecosystems were, well, we'll call them fairly balanced in nature, I guess you can say that there were all types of species, lots of diversity, and the otters were at the, as you say, a keystone species of this ecosystem. And then man shows up and starts harvesting and killing otters by, hundreds or thousands, and damaging these ecosystems to the point where were there forests that were kelp forests that were completely absent of otters?
Yeah, I don't know the really ancient history, but the first humans in North America, which some people call these people the Clovis people, we have archaeological evidence of human beings that crossed over and were found. There's evidence in like New Mexico, Arizona. And we've always thought that they only could have been there post the glaciers retreating. And more recently, there's this evidence that's called the kelp forest hypothesis or the kelp forest highway hypothesis, that people first crossed over the land bridge and then started to come down before the glaciers retreated by following the coast along the Pacific Ocean. And they subsisted off of kelp forests and the food that what they were able to find and the sort of the resources from these kelp forests that were already there along the Pacific coast. So they're very ancient and they're a part of our history and how we first arrived as Homo sapiens in North America. And otters have been a big part of maintaining those kelp forests for a really long time. You're right then that more recently, in more modern history, the fur trade really decimated sea otters, and we kind of hunted them to the point of local extinction, extirpation. And this story is really about when otters are brought back, how they reform the kelp forests that had been there for so long but had been lost because we had hunted otters for their fur. And now that isn't happening in the same way. And we've slowly allowed by helping and also on their own, otters have come back. And these kelp forests have regrown in many places. And this study was trying to understand how do they regrow? Why do they regrow differently in different places? What's the right way to reintroduce species more generally, not just into kelp forests? Very ancient systems that have been a part of our history for as long as we've been in North America.
That's fascinating. Now, talk about that, your research. You basically looked at two kelp forests, one in Southern California area, and then one up in the Northwest, and kind of did a study on that and compared and contrasted the two areas.
That's right. And I just have to say that these are two data sets that are 30 years old, which is just so unheard of in ecology because you have to go out to these places every year, usually during the summer, with a whole field crew. These studies long predate me. And I'm just so grateful to the people who've worked tirelessly for years and years to, no matter what is going on, to go back out there and recollect data. When it was first pitched to me, it was the idea of bringing together these two different data sets that they're very similar the way they were collected because one of the people, Jane Watson, who's also a co-author, she was a student of Jim Estes, also a co-author. Jim started a lot of the California work, and Jane, who was one of his students, got a job at the University of British Columbia and just sort of took those methods up more north along the coast. And so we have these two data sets that have been collected in a really similar way about the same kinds of ecosystems for a long time. And they pitched it to me as a compare and contrast, which for a scientist is that's the holy grail, because no matter what happens, something interesting is going to come out of a compare and contrast. And yeah, what we found is that up north, there's much more of this kind of canonical Keystone effect where we would assume when sea otters are returned to the system, they eat up all the urchins enough to the point where they're sort of back into balance and allowing other species to grow. And it just flips the system back into a kelp forest. And off the coast of California, this happened, but it was much slower. And all the species sort of transitioned through this intermediate state that has persisted for a long time. And the question is really like, why do the keystone species in these systems, these sea otters, why do they behave differently in different places? Wouldn't they do the same thing everywhere? If they're so powerful and they engineer the entire system, then why are they behaving differently in one place versus another if the system is basically the same ecosystem? And part of what we were able to figure out is that it really matters what other species are doing in the system, not just the keystone species. The effect of the keystone species has to ripple out through the whole ecosystem. And these other species, they themselves might not be as important individually as sea otters, but they really sort of regulate how sea otters are able to have their effect. And so a lot of the species in the southern kelp forest by San Nick, they sort of slowed down this transition back to kelp forests and made the reintroduction of sea otters manifest in a different way. And I think that this just sort of is both fascinating and also helps us understand how to anticipate when we bring species back that once we're in a place and then have been lost and we're trying to reintroduce them, how do we expect that they're, you know, that whole dynamic is going to play out?
Getting back to how important our kelp forests are, and then reintroducing these species has that ripple effect that helps the entire ecosystem find that healthier balance, that natural balance that has been disturbed. Also, these kelp forests are very important to all living life. Can you explain what they're doing with carbon and why they can be so important to us as a whole?
Yeah, well, you know, just like we humans, we take in oxygen and produce carbon dioxide when we exhale, and plants are the opposite. They take in carbon dioxide and exhale oxygen. Just as plants do that on the surface, these underwater forests are doing the same thing. We might think because we can't breathe underwater that this wouldn't be happening, but oxygen does dissolve into the water and they absorb an incredible amount of carbon through photosynthesis and also just sort of the growth of all of these underwater forests. That itself is also carbon that's manifesting underwater. And they absorb a lot of carbon, but they also play incredible roles along the coast in stabilizing those coastal communities. There's effects from all the species that live there that prevent things like erosion along the coast. Also just food sources like fish. A lot of the fish that we take out and then we enjoy ourselves are there because they're able to persist inside of these larger ecosystems. And in that way, this single species can have this rippling effect on all kinds of life, both human and other kinds of living things in and around the coast of California, British Columbia, all along. And oh, and one other thing to say is kelp forests are all over the world. Some of the dominant kelp species are a little different, but they're found off the coast of South Africa, all around Australia. They're really all over the world. And so understanding what keeps them healthy here can help all kinds of systems, not just in North America, but everywhere around the world.
I read somewhere that their carbon that they sequester is 20 times more per acre than a land forest, which to me is staggering.
If I had to guess, I would say part of it is that there's such vertical height to these underwater forests that allows them to grow in size in ways that feel really different to people who are just used to wandering around in land and looking at sort of like a land forest. But I'd really encourage anyone listening to, if you don't know how to scuba dive, myself included, go online and just Google kelp forest and look at all these images. They're really inspiring to see these what really look like forests underwater.
I think of coral reefs as a marine-based analogy, and they seem to get all the press, right?
They do,
And
yes.
they're important. They provide physical and chemical and biological benefits to the marine environment and serve as a nursery. But so do kelp forests, as you allude to. They provide a physical, a chemical, and a biological, and eventually an ecological benefit to their local marine system.
This is absolutely right. And not to say that people shouldn't focus on coral reefs, which I think that, like, even just in there, they're just obviously so beautiful that it makes sense why people focus on them. And they do provide, as you're saying, lots of different benefits. But kelp forests, in many ways, are they're like coral reefs in that they are home to so many different species. In some places, kelp forests have more species living in them than in other parts of coral reefs. So I think this is right that we should keep the press on coral reefs, but kelp forests deserve also to be thought of as these hotspots where there's just incredible amounts of biodiversity in very small places in out in the water.
What about climate change? What is a warming world, or in this case, warming oceans, doing, or how are they possibly threatening kelp forest, the health and welfare of kelp forest, and possibly of the otters? And maybe even the
Yeah.
urchins, too.
Interestingly, kelp forests are not found near the equator. There actually was some research that came out not that long ago that found there were some kelp forests that had formed deeper underwater where it was a little cooler, but the kelp actually don't like it when it gets really warm, which is why they're not by the equator. So one obvious effect of warming is that there is an upper limit where these kelp species just don't want to grow in really warm water. The paper itself focuses so much on the biological community. But one thing that we spent a lot of time on was thinking about abiotic variables. So abiotic are non-living things, things like what are the waves like off the coast? How big are the waves? What's the temperature of the water? What's the ENSO cycles? And an interesting thing that we found is that these non-living variables were not actually as important as the living species in our efforts to understand the effects of sea otters. Some of that may be sort of just that in this case, the system is not yet near its tipping point where it's just too warm. It could also be that sea otters are just such a powerful force that understanding what's going on in them right now is really more about protecting the living things there. I guess in a sort of transparent, honest way, this particular study didn't find a lot of evidence of that would be helpful in understanding how changes in the climate would affect these systems. But it's something that we intend to continue following up on, and also would imagine that maybe in other kelp forests around the world, temperature matters much more. Other things like as temperature changes, you get changes in salinity of the water, you get changes in the pH of the water, and maybe these other things are slowly building up and will reach some sort of a tipping point. We didn't see that in this particular study, but we know that kelp forests have a limit where they just can't survive if it gets too warm. So that's something that we hope as we continue to collect data that we can look for how these systems, now that they've reformed, how do they persist into the future amidst all this change?
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Ryan Langendorf, and he is a professor at the University of Colorado. And we're talking about a paper he helped co-author, which is in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And you can go online and see that. The title of the paper is Climate Change Scenarios in Fisheries and Aquatic Conservation Research. And it's kind of focuses on the study of sea otters in a couple locations, one in the Northwest and one in Southern California, and compares and contrasts those otter families, let's call them, populations in terms of their role as keystone species. So in the last few minutes that we have, Ryan, I believe you have a deep background in mathematics or so. And what role do you think that artificial intelligence might be able to play in helping you do research in a deeper way or a more robust way? And because you talk about 30 years of data, that's a lot of data to go through. Does AI have a potential benefit in helping with ecological research?
Oh, this is such a great question. I think right now there's a big debate going on in ecology about how much can we collect data around the world on all kinds of living and non-living things and just feed it into a big AI and then have the AI help us figure out what should we do. And the reason we would, in theory, really love this is because the world is changing really quickly all around us. This is both man-made and non-man-made. There's just so much change in the world right now, and we need answers quickly. And the idea that we could take all the data we have so much data, and just get answers from an AI is really, it's really tempting to want to believe this can help us solve our problems. I think right now we don't know. There are projects like NEON, for example, to just collect standardized data all over North America and see what we can do with that, that we are hoping will lead to some useful breakthroughs. But one of the big takeaways from this paper was that We try to just feed a lot of data in and say, how can we understand kelp forests? How do we understand sea otter reintroductions? And it didn't work. The way that we were able to find useful answers is by talking to experts who have lived in these systems for decades, who helped put bumpers on the models to say some things we know are possible and some are not. And we can let the model run and figure things out inside of the constraints of our own human knowledge. And that actually is how we were able to finally get the model off the ground. And so I guess the answer is, we don't know. We're hoping that maybe AI and these kinds of big data approaches will provide useful answers. And if they do, that's the goal. I just want to help these systems however we can get there. But at least right now, the answer is still we need humans and our own understanding of the world to help make these kinds of models useful.
And I would argue on that point that if we keep extracting ourselves further and further from the natural world and that attachment, then that ability to empathize and care starts to slide. So I feel like when you have human interaction that is deeply seated or deeply entrenched and caring about these kelp forests and caring about these ecosystems and caring about these sea otters, that you develop more of an empathy, which is something I don't think can be brought mechanically or by AI.
I think this is right. And also, like I would add on top of empathy, which is so important, also intuition as a mathematician trying to understand these systems. If you have no intuition for them, you don't even know where to begin. And this idea that just sort of a blank slate with a powerful enough model will solve our problems, we maybe that's true, but we haven't found evidence of that yet. And I agree that part of that is a part of that comes from that understanding of the systems. And also I think that your point about empathy is really important. If we also don't empathize, we find no reason to care. We might say, like, oh, well, what does it matter if they all fall apart? Being in these systems, living with them, understanding them, admiring them, learning from them, realizing we don't understand everything about them is a really important part to getting us to a place where we can be useful and beneficial to these other living things.
And I also think that there's a lot of times in the natural world that we mimic some of the things that are happening there in our own world or in our own lives that work to help us as humans.
Completely agree. Completely agree. Yeah.
And I would, although I agree with what both of you are saying, I think AI could bring something to the table when it comes to trying to analyze the impacts from synergistic effects. That's always a complicated world to look at how, not just say, I'll use water quality as an example, not just to say, like, well, lead in our water is bad for us. And we know we've done research on lead in drinking water, but we need to know a better sense of what lead plus PFAS plus some other volatile compounds in the water, what the synergistic effects are on, let's say, ecosystems. I think AI could perhaps help maybe, bring some a better insight into that in that arena.
The synergistic effects, when you consider them, then the space of possible interactions grows exponentially, and it becomes really complex for us as humans to think about it. AI is one way to get into that complexity. I also think as we empathize, we also build blind spots where we care in a way that makes us want certain things to be true. And sometimes AI can also help just offer a perspective that is very non-human and help us see things that we had lost sight of while dealing with that tremendous complexity of all those synergistic effects. So my vision for the future is one that's collaborative between human and non-human kinds of models with the goal of trying to help these systems in whatever way we can.
Well,
All right.
the study is super interesting, and people can go online to check that out. Ryan, tell us where people can find this study and also more about what you're doing at the Doak Lab.
Yeah, so the study is if you go to the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which scientists just call PNAS, their website, if you search kelp forest sea otters, if you look up my name or Dan Doak's name, you'll find this paper. You have to wait 6 months until it becomes open access. Right now, it's behind a paywall for just for 6 months. But if anyone wants to read this, I would love if they reached out to me, find my email on their website, and I will send you a PDF of it for you to read. And yeah, the Doak Lab is, it's a mix of all different kinds of ecologists who are interested in using quantitative computational mathematical models to understand the natural world. And we're really excited to take this research and try to move into other systems. We already are talking to people who work in Kenya, also other people off the coast of North America, just trying to apply this model in different ways to help other, people who are stuck understanding other kinds of ecosystems. And I'm particularly excited in the idea of maybe focusing on species reintroductions, which is a big thing, not just in aquatic environments. In Colorado, for example, we just reintroduced gray wolves. And so using these kinds of models to understand how we can predict the effects of our own interventions is a big goal of mine.
That's fantastic. Ryan, we appreciate you so much for coming on This Green Earth and telling us a little bit more about that ecosystem and the importance of these kelp forests. And we hope to talk to you again in the future and learn more about what you're writing about and what you're studying there at the Doak Lab. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you
Thanks,
so much
Lauren.
for having me.
And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us now on the show, all the way from Guam, is marine biologist Rania Steinbach. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here today.
First, before we break down some of these new discoveries in the world of marine fungi, share with us your personal path and what led you to marine biology, what made you fascinated about this particular area.
So I'm actually originally from New Mexico, which is a landlocked state, but I think that made the ocean that much more exciting to me, and the opportunity to discover new things there made me want to pursue marine biology. And I got my scuba dive certification as soon as I could. I was pretty young. I was like 13 or 14, I believe. And then just continued on down the path of trying to become the best scientist I could, candidate for college, and then got accepted to the University of Hawaii at Manoa, where I studied marine biology. And right before I actually accepted acceptance to UH Manoa, I had been doing an internship in New Mexico and working with fungi then actually in Dr. Jennifer Rudger's lab. And that was where I really got excited about fungi and kind of this world underneath our feet. But I also still had this passion for marine biology. And when I saw that Dr. Anthony Amend studied marine fungi, I was like, okay, that makes the decision easy for me. I want to go and study at UH Manoa and join Dr. Anthony Amend's lab, which I did as an undergraduate my freshman year, actually, and started with a different project on marine fungi. But as graduation was coming up, I was in the honors program and needed to design my own project. And I got very excited about this idea of looking into the potential of marine fungi and their ability to degrade plastics, since that is such a big problem in the ocean.
Absolutely. I think that we have spoken about this multitudes of times here on This Green Earth about what is happening in our oceans and everyday life. We're breathing it, we're living it. And to have perhaps a way in which nature can take care of this very human-made issue is really fascinating. So walk us through what some of these discoveries are and what you have learned while you've been researching these marine fungi and what they are doing with plastics.
Absolutely. So first of all, we'll go back to kind of the start of the project design and, why are we interested in marine fungi? Well, as we just mentioned, there's a lot of plastic in the ocean. So this hypothesis of fungi in the ocean that are in contact with plastic a lot. We had this idea that, well, maybe they will actually have greater potential for degrading or basically eating plastic, turning, like you said, this human-made product into more fungus, better than terrestrial fungi, which we already know can have this potential to degrade really hard polymers, in wood. That's something that a lot of organisms cannot degrade, and that's one of the big things that fungi are doing under our feet. And so we have this really great collection of marine fungi that have been isolated by PhD candidate Serena Wittner. And those were from all around Oahu. And they were taken from various different types of marine samples. So, just from water samples, from sediments, from some sponges and organisms. And they were already being sequenced so that we would be able to see their DNA. And this kind of opened this really cool possibility of looking into these specifically, already having their, DNA sequenced out so that we could then do further analysis with it after this project. And what we did was then take these strains that we had all this information on and inoculate them onto petri dishes that had 1% polyurethane, which is this type of plastic that we see a lot, especially in the medical field. And this particular plastic is easier to work with because you can get it in an aqueous dispersion. So you add it into these petri dishes and it makes it sort of this milky color. And once these fungi then are on the petri dish, as they eat this plastic, it turns clear. And you can very easily test a large number of fungi for this ability to eat this plastic. And so we did this and we found that about 60% of the strains that we were looking at had this ability, which is a much higher percentage than a lot of the studies that have done with terrestrial fungi in a similar manner. And so that was really exciting. But we wanted to take it a step further as well and see if we could actually increase the rate at which these fungi are able to eat the plastic. Because even in, even looking at a petri dish in 1%, it still was taking a couple of weeks for them to, degrade. Maybe the size of a palm is about the size of the petri dish, is 100 millimeters in diameter. And so that still is pretty slow when we're thinking about the context of this plastic problem. And in general, it is a, these polymers are really hard to break down. And the timing is important to keep in mind when we think about the potential to use this on a larger scale. And so what we did was then start to do these serial inoculations into higher concentrations of polyurethane. So that means taking them from these petri dishes, putting them into a liquid medium where, again, we had this aqueous dispersion, but we went from 1% polyurethane to 5% polyurethane to 10% polyurethane. And at this point, degradation rate was going down a little bit. So then we did a smaller increment to 12%. And from here, after these fungi had adapted to basically having this really hard food source to degrade, but at a higher concentration in the medium, so they were more limited in the other things that they could use for food, we then tested their speed of degradation back with that original fungus. Like it's the same strain, but one that had been put into all these different inoculations and one that hadn't. And we found that for three of them, this actually increased the speed at which it was able to degrade the polyurethane by about 15%, which is pretty significant when we think about this being a pretty short-term experiment and seeing the fact that we can basically condition these fungi to become faster and better at using plastic as their nutrition source.
Let's go back a little bit and first explain what a fungi is or a fungi is, and what is its typical role in a marine environment.
Sure, yeah. So a fungus is neither a plant nor an animal, right? It's its own kingdom. And a lot of times it is studied by botanists because it does have on land this very close relationship with plants. It's what allowed vascular plants to become vascular plants, and survive so well. And we often forget the fact that they are also in the marine environment. And so there, they're doing a some of the similar roles that they perform on land. And this includes parasites, the ones that we think of as, not so great, but they also do help with some of this cycling of materials. And this part is a little, they're very understudied in the ocean. So I suspect they're doing much more than we realize, especially, for example, on the sea floor. Very deep where there's all these sediments and there is all this organic matter that needs to be recycled. And they also are in symbiosis with certain organisms. And I mean, symbiosis, that's this very broad term. Usually we think of a mutual symbiosis, symbiosis, which is true in this case. So sometimes it is conferring a benefit to whatever species it's with, like a sponge or a coral, and it is in return getting, you know, a benefit, often like protection and things like that from that other organism. But it also just depends on the conditions at any given moment, how beneficial or potentially parasitic that fungus is at any given time. And there's also a lot of yeast in the ocean, and those, again, there's a lot of unanswered questions about exactly what they're doing. But they are, in that case, a part of this planktonic community, which, you know, is feeding other organisms. And what's really special about fungi, though, and what makes them unique, is that they have extracellular enzymes that they secrete. So they have really high enzymatic rates of activity. They have tons and tons of these enzymes that they put into the environment, which helps them eat. That is how they eat. They put it outside of themselves. It's as if we turned our digestive system outside of us, secreted all of our stomach acid, and then just absorbed the nutrients that we had then, you know, broken down. And that's why they're such good candidates for things like degradation, because they have this, you know, this arsenal of enzymes and potential to have new enzymes for us to discover that do really cool things like break down plastic.
Okay, so is it safe to say that fungi populate all the realms of the oceans from north to south, pole to pole, and at all depths? They're just ubiquitous to the ocean environment.
Yes, I would say yes.
Okay.
And again, they're still very understudied, but that's what we've been finding.
And then basically they're there to help break down carbon-based matter, right? Detritus, et cetera. So they're kind of patrolling the oceans. That's their source of food?
Yes, some of it is this breaking down of carbon matter, and then in the context of oftentimes parasitism, those are the ones that have been more studied, but also then in symbiosis with things like corals and sponges.
Okay, so you've taken a certain types of fungi and introduced them, as you described, to this type of plastic, one type of plastic. There's many different types of plastic. And so they're just treating that as another type of carbon source, another type of food, basically?
Exactly.
Okay. Do they create, then they, I'm trying to say, when they break it down or they eat the plastic, are they creating a waste, or are they actually converting that plastic into more fungi?
They're actually converting that plastic into more fungi. And current ongoing research, kind of offshoot of this project, is looking into what that plastic is being broken down into, because while some of that is becoming more fungus, likely other parts of it are then just becoming a smaller polymer until eventually it would be some sort of monomer. And so that's what is being examined right now, is looking more into what exactly those enzymes were, and then what kind of those byproducts of this degradation actually is.
So in theory, you talk about training these fungi to do this breaking down faster, and they seem to be responding to this. So this is the theory, is that they may be able to break these down at a higher rate. So in practice, what does this look like?
So this is where we also have to take a little bit of a step back from this, like, okay, we can train them to degrade plastic really quickly. You know, what do? We just release them and then they're going to eat all the plastic in the ocean? No. So that is not going to be a realistic solution, given the fact that, you know, plastic is also being used in important ways in our world. We can't just have suddenly some, you know, rampant fungus just eating all these plastics. So when we think about this in kind of the more practical sense, we think about, okay, we want to figure out what enzymes are doing this. And then we want to collaborate with people who can get this plastic into a controlled place and use these enzymes. The really cool thing about having the genomes of the fungi that we did this kind of conditioning experiment on is that we can look at places where that genome has changed before and after conditioning. And that's what then helps us key in to what part of that genome is responsible for the production of these enzymes and potentially something that we could, for example, transform into a bacteria, put into a bioreactor, and then mass produce these enzymes. And at that point, again, it requires a lot of collaboration and a lot more time to figure out a way to use this on a larger scale. But that possibility of using something that is naturally occurring and actually stop this, just plastic just being broken down into smaller and smaller parts and just continuing in the environment, that's the exciting part about this, is actually being able to have an end to this, really recalcitrant polymer that we're just finding everywhere that's causing so many problems.
Are fungi part of the normal food chain within a marine system? So are plants or other marine animals that are feeding on fungi? I'm trying to think of their role in the food system, in the food chain.
Yeah, I don't know that we necessarily think of it as being like one of the big parts of the food chain, but because it is a part of the planktonic community, it is for sure being consumed. And as a, also carbon-based organism, it definitely is becoming some sort of nutritious or, yeah, planktivores.
Your experiments, your work, your study is right now on one type of plastic. Do you see, you'll have to remind me again what that type of plastic is, but do you see other types of plastics as potentially candidates for this similar process?
That's a great question. And this study actually started off looking into two types of plastic. So the one that we did the study on was polyurethane. And then we also wanted to use polyethylene because that really is kind of the number one produced plastic. That's your, single-time use plastic water bottles
PET, right?
example.
Yeah,
Yeah,
okay.
exactly. And the great thing about, well, not the great thing about polyurethane, but what makes it easier to work with for kind of an initial study like this is that we have this ability to make this aqueous dispersion of it. So it is a plastic that is generally considered, easier to break down for organisms, and you can put it into this aqueous dispersion. So that enabled us to do this kind of really big screening of all the isolates that we had in a pretty short amount of time, right? Because you just add it into the petri dish. We tried to do a similar thing with the polyethylene by taking, polyethylene that had basically been turned into just these tiny little particles and sort of sprinkling it on top of the plate, or, putting it into the medium, but then it just kind of rose to the top of the plate and just kind of became this layer. And then the fungus is going to use all of the carbon inside the, the medium that isn't the plastic before it touches the plastic, because that's more readily available. And you don't get these nice areas of clearance that indicate that there was any degradation. So I noticed this, and then I tried to do it where I took a little piece of a plastic bag and put it into an aqueous medium that didn't have any other carbon source. But that ended up being really challenging with the tools that I had, and as an undergraduate researcher who, just, didn't have as many people I could call on, or, background in especially chemistry, because that's where I started needing to go into was, I was trying to do UV spectroscopy and other methods to try to see if there was degradation of these little squares of plastic bag that I had put in. So it does require collaboration with people who know a little bit more about the tools that could actually quantify this type of degradation. And then the timeline ends up becoming much longer when we start talking about these other plastics. There's some terrestrial studies where, they were running for months and months and even years and seeing, like a 1% decrease in weight of, which was one metric they were using. To answer your question on the more positive note, seeing the fact that there's this potential for degradation with polyurethane, if we find better methods for analyzing degradation in other types of plastic, I do think that marine fungi in particular are a great group to be looking into for having this enzymatic potential to then break down these other plastics as well.
Okay.
I love the idea of, though, mimicking nature and having humans derive these ways in which we can work with what is happening in nature in a very, I guess, a way that nature is healing itself, but we as humans then are pulling from that and saying, how do we mimic this or utilize this? Because it's, I understand it, and you can tell me if I'm correct in saying that you're saying that once you have a greater understanding of this, you're going to find a way to perhaps mimic it on a larger scale.
Yes, I think that's true. And just keeping in mind the fact that, plastic is the largest growing habitat in the ocean right now. And as a result, these organisms that are able to utilize something as a food source, if they're ever limited in other food sources, are going to turn to that. That's biology. And so that's why these are such a great candidate, and why, anyway, I think that likely this, plastic degradation is likely already happening in some place in the ocean and maybe on a small scale. And again, probably only when limited in being able to, get food from something that's a lot easier to eat, so to speak. But it is kind of incredible that biology does always find a way, nature finds a way on its own. And I think that's why bioremediation is such a promising and exciting area of study.
Tell us about
When
that when
you're
you say bioremediation.
So even beyond plastics, I think that fungi, I'm a fan of the fungi. Fungi in particular just have this huge potential for helping us solve a lot of the problems that we are creating for ourselves. We've seen that fungi can, remove heavy metals from water and contaminated soils, even radiation. We see that their mycelium is able to make these polymers that do break down on their own and are still super, super, hard if that's how we design it to be, or flexible and can be used to replace plastic. So just this idea of using what nature is already doing to help us solve our problems without unknowingly introducing more problems because we're adding, trying to use some chemical that we create, I think is really the way that we are going to start to heal the relationship that we have unfortunately kind of been a negative relationship that we have been creating with the natural world over the last years.
We obviously we see evidence of plastic pollution in marine environments, mostly along, on the surface, right? The plastic washing up on the beaches, et cetera, floating around on the top of the water. When you're diving, give us our listeners a sense of the extent of plastic that you're seeing underwater when you're diving in areas that you would not think you would see plastic.
Yeah, I guess one that you do expect, of course, is things like fishing nets, which also are made out of these, plastic ropes and things like that, fishing line. Ones that maybe you don't see as often, but that we know are there, is the fact that, these plastics are breaking down into microplastics. And on the bottom of the seafloor, currently I'm, on Guam. We're right by here by the Marianas Trench, and I'm sure down at the bottom, at the deepest part of the ocean, if we looked through those sediments, we would be finding plastic. And that's kind of sad that, that's this untouched place that we think is untouched by us, and yet still, chances are, I mean, actually, for sure, there's plastic down there. And it isn't always so. When I'm just going out and diving, it's not like I'm seeing tons and tons of plastic every given moment. But the fact that even when I'm out, quite far from shore, and there still is, this plastic, like partially degraded water bottle thing that got stuck between a coral and now also is preventing a new coral from establishing itself right on that spot is just really really sad to see, and it really is everywhere.
Yeah, and Marianas Trench, give our listeners, real quick, our listeners a sense of just how deep that trench is.
Yeah, so it is the deepest part of the ocean.
Right, and wouldn't surprise you if somebody took a core sample down at the bottom of that trench that they come up with some form of plastic at this point,
Yeah.
what we've done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Almost 7 miles deep.
We're gonna have to leave it at that, Rhonda.
Well, very fascinating. I love that you have clearly such a passion for this, and that we have someone out there like you trying to solve these issues in the way that you are. It's super exciting to me, and we appreciate you being on the show. It's Rania Steinbach, who is a marine biologist and has been studying marine fungi and how they are degrading plastics. Thank you so much, Rania.
Thanks,
Thank you
Ron.
so much for having me.